All right. Good morning. This is Keeping It Real. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. Our guest today is Ty Carpenter from Don't Shoot Portland. Thanks for being here, Ty.
Thank you so much for having me, Lisa. Good morning, everyone.
Excellent. Don't Shoot Portland continues with its community history archiving project for everyday people. It's this Saturday, Don't Shoot is holding a free archiving workshop called Better Than a Shoebox, Preserving Your Family and Community History. You've got to sign up online, folks, and we'll give you that information later. Ty, thanks again for being here. I want, if we can, to start out talking about the history of Don't Shoot Portland to give listeners a bigger picture of what you do and what you have done. There's so many new people here. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Excellent. Don't Shoot has the reputation of going head to head with Portland city leaders and Multnomah County leaders and law enforcement on issues of racism and police violence. But you all go beyond lawsuits and protests. That's my opinion.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. There is a lot involved in the work that we do, but ultimately we're just seeking accountability for families and loved ones that have been either lost to gun violence, police brutality, or discriminative policy, or people whose lives have just been irreversibly changed. I believe, you know, in 2020, a lot of those images from the protests still stand out in our minds. And a lot of people that were down there protesting, you know, they ended up being a part of our class action lawsuit, which led to discovery, which also led us to, you know, get a peek at Portland Police Bureau's training slides and things like that. And that kind of revealed a pretty harsh perspective of how they were treating people out there that were exercising their right to protest. And that's kind of what has led full circle, really, for us to be doing this archiving work. We think it's crucial to capture stories. We think it's important to speak to people in your life that may be older, people in your family that may have their own histories to share, because time just moves so quickly, especially, like I said, 2020. There was a lot of trauma, I think, that people were exposed to. We were isolated, and then there were, you know, groups of communities coming together to stand up against police brutality and racial violence, and they were met with more violence and harm for standing up. And I don't think people have gotten over that. I know a lot of the communities that we serve are still, you know, having flashbacks. They're still affected by that. So we try to not only inform folks of their rights and how to exercise those rights, but we connect them with legal advocacy so that they can feel safe in standing up for themselves.
One of the things I think is really fascinating about Don't Shoot Portland is the ways that organizationally, and your mom, Teresa Rayford, who is, I think Teresa's the founder, is that accurate?
Yes, I think so. Teresa was the founder. Now she's executive director.
Teresa strategically brought lawsuits against municipal governments that they didn't all win, but I'm saying you're right. They brought more information into the public domain, which is its own goal. And if anyone's listening right now, they're not quite sure what I'm talking about. Last January, this story hit the Oregonian. Portland police training on protests ends with slide showing mock prayer for dirty hippie, comma, prompts investigation. Don't Shoot Portland brought a lawsuit, and the discovery, as Ty was saying, the discovery, the sharing of information about how the police bureau did their thing actually led to a whole lot of a larger understanding of what's for the people who did not understand already of what's wrong inside the police bureau. And I have to say, Teresa Rayford is, she ran for office. She's run for office. She's an incredible person. And she has a reputation, again, for being a civil rights, a civil justice activist. And yet, when I have worked with Teresa, her umbrella is actually, it covers everyone. It's not an umbrella for one group of people. And that's a weird thing to say, but I do have to say it. It's a big, open community of people. So when my memory of the civil unrest of 2020, Don't Shoot Portland did a lot. Like, I feel like you gave away food and clothing. You had big giveaway. Talk about that a little bit too, just the anti-poverty work. I would describe that as anti-poverty work.
Absolutely. And my mom always says, Teresa always says, you know, Don't Shoot Portland is a community action plan. And that truly means what it sounds like. Every single one of us has something to contribute, has something to offer. We all have something to learn from one another, whether you're an educator or a nurse or, you know, a union laborer, a tradesman, whether you're a young child, whether you're an older person. There's so many different things that we encounter in our lives. And if we don't know what the other person is struggling with or, you know, wants to amplify an injustice, how are we supposed to work together to make it happen? And once you get those people in the same room advocating for each other's issues, it becomes very clear that this is the way that you not only build community, but that you can build a community of resistance where you can get accountability and people can, you know, we can increase our quality of life, hopefully, you know, at the end of the day. So I would definitely say it's a big umbrella of people, because at the end of the day, it's all very intersectional, the issues that community members face.
I guess I wanted, I could talk with you all day about this. I guess I'm a retired journalist now. I guess all of journalism is retired. Haha, that was a joke. I think back on my like 40 years of writing and reporting just in this city. And I can't think of very many people who have been so strategic in their partnerships as Don't Shoot Portland as an institution has been. And can you talk a little bit, I feel like you're a gallery assistant. Can you talk a little bit about Don't Shoot Portland's embracing of fine art? I'm saying that, like there's a partnership with the Portland Art Museum, partnership with the University of Oregon Knight Library. Like you guys have big partnerships. You could talk about the work you've done with the Portland Art Museum, if that's okay.
Yes. So a lot of the work that we do, like you said, you know, working with different institutions to put on installations and exhibits that will inform and encourage people to self-educate as well. We're big on data. We're big on spreadsheets, archiving, research. Every installation we've done recently, and, I mean, the last 4 or 5 years.
I'm going to say 5 years. Yeah.
Like recently. What is time? But we always include QR codes. We always have an open source spreadsheet so that we can cite all of our sources, any copyright that we've, you know, attained through images being used. You know, we kind of include that along with the links to all of our studies and different research papers from that person to show why they're being included or why we're, you know, talking about them in this installation. And I think that's important. I think it allows people to know that, oh, this is evidence-based work. This is an evidence-based installation. Because a lot of times when you're vocalizing social issues, some people will try to, you know, say that you're focusing on it too much.
Or you're biased or
whatever. Yeah. And so presenting the evidence and the education is almost a shield. It's almost a layer of protection, because if someone doesn't like what they're learning, they can easily go and learn it themselves.
What fascinates me about the whole idea of what the work that Don't Shoot Portland has done is that over and over again, organizationally, you give people original sources. We're going to start talking about the Liberated Archives for Black Lives show and the whole archiving project, but an original source is something historians deal with. Like, we're so used to talking about journalism criticism and stuff like that. But journalism, we were never even really all taught how to fact check or anything. When it comes to history and it comes to archiving and it comes to, and when it comes to how academics figure out, or these space aliens of the future that land, actually, they're always going to come out of the soil, aren't they? Whatever. When the space aliens examine our culture, they're going to be looking for, like, what did people say themselves? And that's what archives are. And to remind people that their life experience is important and is going to be important for the future. When I went to the University of Oregon and I studied African-American history and culture under a guy named Dr. David Anthony. And it's totally okay if we cry. I guess I'm always close to crying anymore. Dr. David Anthony, he is still a professor, I believe, at the University of Santa Cruz. He taught alongside in the same institution as Angela Davis. And he's the first person who said, okay, these are the original narratives of enslaved people from 300 years ago. Read them, right? Even if you look at the Ain't I a Woman speech by Sojourner Truth, that's actually not an original source of information. Like when you start to understand some of these things, it changes your perspective and it gives you, you listener, more tools to figure out what's going on around you. I love that. So can you talk, okay, I want to back up a little and say the Liberated Archives for Black Lives show at the Souvenir Arts Gallery on Alberta Street. And that came down, I think it ended in June. But talk about that show. What was it? And what, why was it important?
Absolutely. So Liberated Archives for Black Lives is an ongoing series that we've been doing. We actually went, when we did the Souvenir Arts show, we brought it up for Juneteenth to sort of celebrate and, you know, commemorate that holiday and to also use it as a time, you know, why not educate our community? And Souvenir Arts Gallery is located on 12th in Alberta. And so we used a petition that was actually from the 1940s, and it was residents of Albina wanting to disallow black people from settling in Albina. So for us, it was the perfect location geographically.
Oh, yeah.
We had a lot of people coming in, and, you know, every time we put up Liberated Archives, someone will come in and they'll recognize a name on the petition. They'll recognize an address on the petition, and they will ask us, depending on how they feel, do you have the right to use this? Where did you get this? This is my great-great-grandmother's home. And
I would prefer to keep this secret. Sorry, it just came out of my mouth.
And I always say, well, they were proud to sign their name. They were eager to sign this petition, and that's why it is now public record, and that's why it's on these walls. So I always look forward to those conversations because they can be difficult, but I think, like I said, there's a layer of protection there. So I like being able to present the information and see what they do with it. And then when that came down at the end of June, we actually went with the University of Oregon's Knight Library to Washington, D.C., and we presented at the Society of American Archivists Conference. And that was incredible. We were official panelists. We talked about our Liberated Archives work, and we had over 200 people signed up for our talk. And It was incredible, honestly, just being able to be in a room full of historians and scholars and educators who understood what we were doing and were, you know, in awe and excited that this profession that they're used to, you know, archives, someone is actually using this information in a way that can be a beacon of hope and strength for people. Like, it felt really affirming to be there. I couldn't even believe that I was in Washington, D.C. presenting on a panel. I felt like it was, you know, a very big moment for my career and my life, and being able to do it with my mom through the work that we've gotten so close together, doing this research together, even installing together, that's hours of time and frustration and conversation. Like, it just brought us together closer, and we got to share that with the whole audience of people, and now it's on, you know, it's part of our record now. You have this beautiful presentation on our work, and it's gone all the way to Washington, D.C.
And in Washington, D.C., which in my head, somehow, I always think of that as the ultimate gentrified city, which was built by enslaved people. If you just tuned in, this is Keeping It Real. I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest today is Ty Carpenter from Don't Shoot Portland. Don't Shoot PDX continues with its community history archiving project for everyday people this Saturday. Don't Shoot is holding a free archiving workshop called Better Than a Shoebox, Preserving Your Family and Community History. And it's with the Portland Archives. Okay, if you're listening right now, I'm Lisa Loving. I'm a nerd, and you know I've got my entire presentation on a laptop computer in front of me, but I'm just going to wad it up and throw it out right now because I'm so excited about this workshop and the people at that Portland Archives. Those folks have pivoted. And a couple people retired recently. They hired new staff. They hired a dedicated community engagement staff. And they're going to start taking the time to educate people about what an archive, listener, if you're listening right now, an archive is you and your life. The letters you wrote, the stuff you signed, even if you didn't think it was important. And it is important. So, Ty, how did you connect with the Portland Archives?
So Teresa has been going to the City of Portland Archives for I know it was pre-pandemic. I can only think in like pandemic years for some reason. Yeah. But I want to say like since 2017, she's been working with them, maybe even before that. And she's, you know, done presentations where she's invited the archivist to speak on different, you know, chapters of history in Portland. And she's combined that programming. And I think it was exciting for them to be a part of that. And so I'm not surprised that, you know, they've pivoted into being able to really dedicate someone to the community engagement aspect, because it really is so important. The city archives, they are a resource for the community. Anyone can go or call, you know, COVID, call and make an appointment, and you can look up your family's history. You can look online. If you're not from Oregon, you can look online for anything. State archives, institutional archives, and you'll find a wealth of information, and you'll go down a rabbit hole, and it's amazing. And if you have archivists like we do that work at the city of Portland, they are eager to uncover this with you. They're like, oh, yay, this person's coming in. I know they're going to want to look at this. And they will go out of their way to pull material for you that they think will align with what you're looking for. And so that was crucial for us, having, you know, people that were dedicated and supported my mom and wanted her to seek this information out. She started coming in on her own, and then they started pulling stuff ahead of her visits. They're like, oh, Teresa's coming in. Let's all get on deck and bring in everything we need. And she would have all of this, you know, all of these materials, all these documents to go through. And like you said, the archive is letters, it's papers, it's photographs.
The phone book. It's the city map.
The phone book. The city map. It's, you know, letters to the commissioner. It's, you know, those communications between city officials and employees. All of that stuff. And the older you get, the older you dig into the archives, the more you realize that they just did not. And I mean, that's probably today too, but it's just very reckless, the things that they've said.
City of Portland municipal officials and leaders, yeah.
Like, it's damning when you read some of it. I'm like, this was a regular correspondence with your stationery on it, and you're talking this way about these people and not hiding it?
Ty, I have to tell you that the first time I ever went to the Portland Archives, which is basically a glass tower at the Portland State University, let me just say, it's by the ice cream store. You don't need to know anything about it. Me and my former colleague, Bruce Poinsett at the Scanner News Group, we were doing our history. It's Black History Special Edition. And we really wanted to do it about police surveillance. But in the end, we ended up having to, we were sort of prevented from doing that. So we pivoted and did it about the Black Panthers, which is a story of surveillance. So the people from the, we said that when we went into the archive, and it was a woman with the most charming horn-rimmed glasses, no kidding, was there. And she brought in all these things about law enforcement, but then she said to us, you know, nobody ever looks in our Black Panthers box. Would you mind, like, if I went and got the Black Panthers box, would you look through it? And we're looking at what is a Black Panthers box? And she brought a banker's box full of slips of paper. Honestly, it was filled with slips of paper and photographs. You've already seen a lot of it, because the people of the archives are smart, and they've connected with other people to get this information out there. But I'll never forget, one of the things in that box was a scrap of paper in red ballpoint pen, and it was written by Tom Potter, the former chief of police, Tom Potter. But this is when he was a patrol officer in the 70s, and he was told to, I think, surveil the children's breakfast program or something like that. He was told to have a shift where he was surveilling members of the Panthers. And this red thing written, this red note, you could tell that he thought it was, wow, I almost cursed. You can't curse on the air, y'all. You could tell that he thought it was not a legitimate assignment. And in red ballpoint pen, he wrote on, it looked like a cookie wrapper too, which was another layer of disrespect to his bosses, no offense. And he basically said, nothing happened. No one came. We didn't do anything. It's not important. He basically trashed the whole assignment in his report to his officer. I mean, to his manager. I would have never seen Tom Potter like that. And I would have never known that officers snarked back at their bosses like that. But that's what we're talking about at the archives. So I love the Portland Archives. And we're right now basically saying that's an incredible public resource, the Portland Archives. What's the Portland Archives doing with Don't Shoot Portland on Saturday?
So on Saturday, we're going to be doing an oral history booth. And we're also going to be digitizing and scanning photographs, documents, and we're asking folks to bring in their own material. So there is a registration link that you said we're going to go over it later, but it's on our website too. And it kind of outlines what material to bring so that, you know, you don't go running through your attic and bringing a bunch of stuff. But we are encouraging people to bring their own materials and just, you know, or even bringing, you know, I'm going to have my grandma there and she is going to do an oral history. So I'm excited to do that with her and learn more about her life living here as a young child in Portland. And also she's going to tell me about my great-grandfather, who was a first lieutenant for the Black Auxiliary Police here in Portland. So that's really exciting for me. I'm still uncovering so much of my own family history by talking to, you know, my elders that are still alive. So I'm just like, every day I feel honored to have access to someone that has more information, you know?
I love history. And I want to add to that, a lot of people don't think that children are part of history, or that people who are a teenager now have an oral history. But anyone who's listening to me right now, if you're doing an oral history project, consider including teenagers, because teenagers know things. When I think of all the teenagers that have massively walked out of class for the climate protests against climate change, I wish that someone went and interviewed them, because that's history. Okay, I'm going to ask a pointy question now. What does this history have to do with gun violence or preventing gun violence? That's a really pointy question.
I mean, I think when you start to get into it, you start to see that a lot of the issues that we're facing today, they stemmed from somewhere, right? There's a lot of criminalization that happens in legislation and in policy. And I think when you start to sort of uncover or unravel that, you're kind of left with like a mountain of evidence. And it is a lot to go through and, you know, figure out and decipher. But there's a lot of laws that were created, you know, as our founding as a state that are still in effect today. There's a lot of surveillance that's been embedded into our legislation and policies, and those still affect people today. So I think the only way really is by looking back, how did we get here? What is the language of that law in particular? What does this ordinance really mean? Where did it stem from? And being able to follow literally a paper trail, I think it can help inform you and let you know that a lot of these things, a lot of these ordinances, were kind of rooted in bias, usually racial bias, and also, you know, made kind of designed to be a detriment to people too. So it's more of, you know, discovering evidence. But I've seen how it works. I've seen the gang task force meetings and the audits that have come up over the years. A lot of those audits were only, you know, put together because of the demand of local community leaders like Don't Shoot Portland and other people who were, you know, seeking advocacy, seeking justice, and saying this couldn't just be a pattern. What's going on here? And actually wanting to look deeper into that. So I think it has a lot to do with today. You know, you can look back and you can look at what's going on, what was written, what was put into law, see how the language has slightly evolved, and usually not very much. I don't know if that answered your question, but it's very entangled.
It's a pointy question, because in our society we're slotted into retail markets. I see that's how I think that we're sort of organized as a society. Who is marketed to for what? Is this person like shoes, or does this person like food? And so we don't really think a lot about where we came from. Mm-hmm. Or what we're doing here. And the other thing that's interesting to me about this is the idea of baselines. I read the most fascinating essay in the paper last week that talked about, it was an environmental essay written by a young environmental scientist. And she was talking about how in her generation, they have a different baseline for what they expect to see in their environment, what they're dealing with. My niece is actually a water scientist in California. So she's about 30 years old. So she has a certain baseline of what she expects to see when she's doing field work. But the people that did this job before her, their baseline was formed 20 years earlier. So they saw different things. There were different things that should be there, but the younger generation misses out on that, because there's no way to communicate it, which that fascinates me. This issue of culture, this issue of community and municipal politics is the same way. We don't maybe realize what has or hasn't changed. And as I have to say, Tari Carpenter, of Don't Shoot Portland, my guest right now, when we look at what happens on the municipal level, who's in City Hall, what are they talking about? I guess I'm never running for office. These people shovel a lot of dog food into a lot of holes, but time just covers them up. A retired journalist, I worked for years at the Scanner. What struck me about it was every time some new person came as mayor, with a couple of exceptions, every time some new person came as mayor, they would establish an exhausting committee, a grassroots committee, a blue ribbon committee of local people who all come together and meet for 6 months to issue an opinion about something. And what they decide is stuck on a shelf and nobody ever looks at it again. There was this thing called the Albina Plan. We've seen, let me stick with the Albina Plan. I think it was made in the 80s, maybe. And literally 30 people who are some of the best and brightest people, especially African-American people, were part of a committee that generated this plan. This is what the city should do for the future. Well, I mean, if I told you that Charlie Hales is the city commissioner that commissioned that plan, we can all laugh. He's probably on his yacht somewhere. Who knows where that guy is? He does have a yacht. But even he, I asked him about it once, and he just shrugged and said, that's politics, basically. That's not exactly what he said, but that's basically what he said. So when people have these commissions, like the Charter Commission that we recently had, the commission to figure out the new form of government, and then the city commissioners come over and say, no, we don't think that those citizens know what they're talking about. We're just going to tweak what they did. This is the history, right? I think it's worth it to understand and know not only the history, but what are the other piles of information that have been deposited against by the side of the road in the past. I think that's fascinating. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Keeping It Real. I'm Lisa Loving, your host. Our guest today is Ty Carpenter from Don't Shoot Portland. Don't Shoot is holding a free archiving workshop called Better Than a Shoebox, Preserving Your Family and Community History. It's this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's at a location in Northwest Portland, and you have to sign up for it on their website. What's your web address? It's like
don'tshootpdx.org.
It's don'tshootpdx.org. Ty, who do you want to come to that event? And what do you want them to do?
I want everyone to come. I mean, like I said, I'm bringing my grandma. She called me this morning and, you know, was all excited. She's like, okay, it's Saturday, right? I'm like, yes, it's Saturday. You have to be there. But I just want anyone who's ever been interested in what is an archive, you know, what is my family history? Oh, I've somehow been the one that's taking care of these photo albums. I ended up being that person in my family. I was like, how do I have these?
It's kind of a heavy burden.
And it's incredible because you're like, oh my gosh, like I'm like the caretaker of these. I have to make sure that they're safe and they're good. And my grandma's always asking, will you take a picture of that one picture? I think it's in the front of the photo album. I'm going to release them from the plastic because that is actually eating away at your images. So, you know, I always say, you know, like Liberated Archives, liberate those images from that plastic, get them out of there, get them into some acid-free folders, digitize them, make sure that they're preserved for your history, your future. I mean, it's very interesting even going through photo albums because sometimes if you don't have that person or that generation there with you, there's a whole storytelling element in how the photos are laid out, if there's documents next to them, and it's sort of telling a story that you don't have the words to. So you really have to look at the way this photo album is laid out before you start taking it apart, and you can learn from that. You can learn why they placed this photo here, why are these two images next to each other, and you can kind of find the connection and the relationship of those images and of those documents. So I want people to just come and, you know, check your attic, bring your things. You know, if you're a longtime Portland resident, even better. If not, if you just moved here and you're looking to get involved and you think it sounds interesting, come on through. I mean, it's free. Everyone is leaving with a archiving kit. So it'll be, you know, you'll be able to go home and work with the rest of your materials a little bit. And then you can also build that relationship with us to be a part of our programming so that you can come back and digitize on your own time. You can create a relationship with the City of Portland Archives. And that way, you know, you can have that skill.
If you're trying to call in on the phone right now, I want to apologize. I'm not able to take a call. I'm actually engineering this show. Anyone who's listening, This is a volunteer-run organization, so if you want to be on the air, if you want to be an engineer, contact the wonderful station volunteer. That's volunteer@kbu.fm. I'm not able to answer the phone right now, but I really appreciate people who are calling. I want to go back to Better Than a Shoebox because I've got the information in front of me, and I just think this is the coolest thing ever. And also, before I do that, though, I'm an information hoarder. Anyone who knows me knows that. And my head, if you could go into my head, it's boxes from the floor all the way to the ceiling, right? It could, my brain could fall on me and I could be hurt. But I love Ancestry.com. I've been doing genealogy for years and totally okay if we cry now. One of the things that I didn't understand is that when I was going through family archives and family stories is that I would find information that broke my heart that I would never be able to forget. And so when I brought photos, I made this little photo album, a little zine for my family that listed all of our ancestry. I was so excited about it. We have some really horrible ancestors and some really great ancestors. That's just the way it is in the human world. But I also, when my relatives who had strokes, when my elderly relatives looked through the photos, especially this one particular relative, it brought memories back to her. And the family started talking about the two women in the family that were sexually trafficked in the past two generations. That would be my auntie and my sister, okay? So this was like 6 years ago that I learned this. I'm an old woman now, and I still can't get over it. It changed the whole trajectory of my life. So when you're doing archives of your family, you're doing genealogy of your family, this stuff hurts. To see that there's a document that would make it illegal for everyone in your family to live on a certain street, there's an emotional component to it. And I'd be a jerk if I didn't just drop that seed. That's a real thing. But what I did want to say was the archivist, back to the event itself. Like, I planted the seed of, be careful, this is not necessarily a feel-good activity. And people could cry, and it's okay to cry because we're humans, not artificial intelligence robots. The cool thing about the Better Than a Shoebox workshop, aside from the fact that it's run by these incredible, they're women from the Portland Archives. They're wonderful people, fascinating people who want to hear the stories of everyday people. You just don't get that every day. But they're giving attendees a kit so that you can begin to actually start preserving your family materials, or whatever materials. It could be something from a nonprofit that you've worked for, or something from something else. I actually have piles and piles of documents from the city of Portland that I accumulated as a journalist, and they sit in a pile. I actually have, this is going to sound nutty, but I've got a copy of the police report from the riot outside of former police chief Charles Moose's house that Geechee Dan organized. And Geechee Dan, we love you, man. I don't know where you are, but this is just a prayer for you and yours, Geechee Dan. Anyway, if you know what I'm talking about, you do. But that thing is like a size of two phone books. Do you remember the list of what the archivists are going to give people? I'm looking for it here. I don't quite have it. There's acid-free paper. There's envelopes. It's actually really cool. I'm looking through the thing. They're going to have three scanners on site for scanning demonstrations. No single attendee will be able to scan all of their photos, but there'll be plenty of opportunity to learn how to make a high quality preservation scan of a photo print. Of a 35 millimeter slide or a photographic negative. That's just super interesting. And I'm going to go back and say, I think everybody should try to sign up for this workshop. It's limited how many people can go. But for a free workshop like this, normally you'd pay somebody $500 and take a class at PCC. I'm not against that. But this is incredible. You were just going to say, did you look up the list of what they're going to get? They're going to give you a whole kit of stuff. But this is what they're asking. The archivists, and I love this, examples of what to bring an envelope of loose photos, one scrapbook or album, a shoebox or folder full of letters. I love that. Your grandmother's recipe cards. She only had one and it was for biscuits. Anyway, a small box of 35 millimeter slides, any item with a specific problem you'd like to discuss. If it's faded, smelly, discolored, or falling apart, pack it carefully. And what they're asking people not to bring is the first thing I gathered together when I decided I was going to this, right? I pulled together an entire bag of binders full of stuff because I was so excited.
know
what not to bring. All 12 of your family albums. That's kind of what I had. For real. 7 boxes of 4x6 prints. 6 slide carousels and a projector, because I would be that excited. A box of VHS home movies. We'll discuss videotapes, but we won't do much hands-on at the workshop. Ty Carpenter, I just want to shift gears a tiniest bit. I don't want to freak you out. In the work that you're doing with Don't Shoot Portland, this is a marathon. It's not a quick race. For the people who come to this workshop, how do you think we'll benefit? What do you want to see happen? What do you want to see happen for the people who come to this workshop?
Well, I definitely want to see people have, you know, be excited about sharing the information and being able to like get closer to their family through this way. I think archiving is usually a very like solitary act, and being able to do it in community with each other, like you said, it's emotional. So it's not all like, yay, you know, let's do this together.
But, and then we had popsicles. It's not like that, actually.
Yeah, but
I'm not saying you don't have popsicles, but
yeah, we'll definitely have refreshments. we'll see about popsicles if it's super hot. But, you know, it's just nice to see people building community in a way where, like you said, this is a marathon, not a sprint. The work that we do, it's very emotional. It's very hard. And sometimes, you know, it's like critical response work. So any chance that we get to, whether we're making art together as a community or we're actually, you know, digging into each other's history as a community, it's kind of uplifting work at the end of the day. We can see that it's progressing people towards something, you know, fulfillment. We can see that it's making a positive change actively right there where they're digging through and they're like, oh, I've never touched this photo before. I've never seen it in this high resolution before. Things like that, like it's, you know, it's beautiful to witness. And I really hope that, you know, amongst, you know, community members and whoever decides to show up, that we also have some advocates and some activists in the place, in the area, because I think that that's going to be important. Those are skills that, you know, skill sharing is important as well. And I think that the more people that are able to attend and have this workshop, not just as, you know, something that you can do because you have a Saturday free, but something that, you know, you can gain this knowledge and then share it with others. That's the best way to retain any sort of information, is by, you know, immediately sharing it. So why not expand your skills? Why not learn more about preserving your history? And it'll change your perspective on things. And like you said, people begin to remember things just by seeing a photo, you know, just by handling that photo and that those documents, you start to, something clicks. And it can be, you know, an eye-opening moment. You may discover that you really enjoy this. You may discover that, you know, actually I want to, you know, it's like a puzzle. You're like, I've got these images, I've got these pieces, but I want to know the full thing now. And now that you've dipped your toes in, you can start that journey on your own. And you never know what you're going to find. I think it's so important for us to be in those spaces together and be willing to uncover the history together and dig through that together. It just builds better community.
To me, it feels like one generation passing a lit torch to another generation, although it might not exactly be that thing. You know, maybe all the generations already have their torches lit and we're all just juggling the torches, you know. But again, the thing that struck me about really dabbling in my family's photos, and then my mom started making a cancer list for my cousin who in Oklahoma, who is going to go get a full, he thinks there's something wrong with him and he's going to go get a physical, and my mom helped him make a list of everyone in the family's cancer history, which was actually, that's important, that's actually part of it too, like medical documents, like I had no idea how many people. That her project, her process of doing that also outlined how many people in my family have mental health problems. And this is also part of the history. Like how my auntie, who was pimped out by her husband, my mom found my grandma's medical record folder, and it had all the letters that had been written to my grandmother from people in mental health institutions all across the country. It's totally okay if we cry right now. And her pimp, who was her first husband, had been checking her into psych wards all across the country. And okay, so you might say to yourself, what does that mean? Right? That's just your family story. That's the history of women in mental health. That's the history of women in mental health institutions. And because she was married to this person, technically married, her family had no power over anything that happened. And it's all laid out in letters from the people who were the directors of the psych hospitals. It's just shocking. There's even a couple letters written by the pimp. I'm using that word in such a negative way, and I'm actually not going to apologize for that. The guy she was married to, her pimp, actually wrote her letters and letters to Evie and to my grandmother too. And that's kind of what I'm talking about. When can your family's either totally overwhelmingly positive or totally overwhelmingly negative history with something important? Where does that touch our society? Our social issues, because what I read, I just saw this folder for the first time last year, and what that told me was that the baseline of mental health services and also law enforcement, as it appears, as it impacts crime against women, it hasn't really changed much. And that's kind of what we're looking at. Like that, to me, that's the, we're talking about puzzle pieces. That's the puzzle piece. If you just tuned in, this is Keeping It Real. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. Our guest today is Ty Carpenter with Don't Shoot PDX. This Saturday, Don't Shoot is holding a free archiving workshop called Better Than a Shoebox, Preserving Your Family and Community History. You got to sign up on their website, and we all agree that it was don'tshootpdx.org. I want to shift gears again a little bit, Ty. I don't mean to freak you out.
No, never.
It's a small airless room. I want to bring the focus back to how we live now. What is our city like? What is our society like now? And what does that mean? Like, and also how do people participate with Don't Shoot Portland? But when you look around the city, the metro region now, what do you see?
So I am 32 years old and I do not know how to drive a vehicle. So my main source of transportation, I walk everywhere. Because of that, I feel like I just, every single day, I'm spending hours, you know, walking from, you know, downtown to the Pearl, through Northwest, you know, all over the downtown area especially. And it just, it feels dismal. I think to a lot of people that are not involved in like local politics, local measures, they, you know, might come up with their own assumptions of what's going on. But to me, I just see a lack of care and a lack of investment to the most vulnerable by our city government. And because of the archives, I've seen that this is sort of a state mandated measure of punishment that has been in effect since Oregon was founded as a state. I mean, if we go back to like Portland, you know, Oregon's poor farms and how they would criminalize anyone coming into Oregon, anyone coming into the United States, force them to stay there, work for, you know, sums that you can barely survive on. And if you attempted to leave the poor farm to make your own livelihood for your family, they would arrest you. They would jail you for, you know, whatever small reasons and then steal your money and, you know, send you back there. And these were people, I mean, it wasn't just, you know, black people that were not allowed in Oregon. They were criminalizing anyone that came into Oregon, you know, any immigrant, any person. And I think that those measures of punishment are definitely still reflected in our state's constitution, because look at how we treat people. Look at the lack of mental health services that we have, but the fact that we've, you know, overexploited this population and said, you know, we need more money to help them. We need more money, and they don't want to go to the shelters. The shelters are not safe. Every resource we've set up for these people, they're met with more violence. And it's just, it's scary. I feel every day, you know, I'm calling Portland Street Response and, you know, hoping that I get a response. And when I do, you know, when those folks show up, sometimes I get a very caring individual that is there to make sure that this person is okay, to talk with them, to walk with them through what they're going through and help them get situated. And other times, I don't know if anyone is like hearing these calls. I don't know if there's anyone on the other side of that line. I see so many people in Portland that love this city, that want to make it better, that want to change lives, they want to change the world. And I think they're met with a lot of resistance from our city council and from people that just want to ignore the problem and they, you know, believe this propaganda that people want to be out there on the street or, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps sort of thing. And there's like a constant butting of heads with that. But the activist community, and that doesn't mean that you're, you know, protesting every day. An activist means someone that is actively wanting to change the world for the better and can, you know, connect with our community in that way, however you can, whether it's seeing a need and fulfilling it, a neighbor in need. Those people are the ones that really give me hope because they know that this is, like you said, a marathon, not a sprint. You help where you can. You get involved where you can, when you can. You don't just fall into that propaganda that people want to be out there or that, you know, we need to treat them badly. So that's what I see every day. I see people really trying to make a difference, and I love that. And we need to be together to do that and make it possible. And then I see people that are just fine with the status quo and that don't think it concerns or affects their lives, but it hurts all of us.
Yeah, I hate to think of how the film series of The Matrix by the Wachowskis is. It does kind of reflect the reality that I perceive about the city of Portland. Ty, are there places where you think that everyday people's participation can be particularly impactful right now? Just in your experience, what should we be doing?
Absolutely. I think people should be more civically engaged, for sure. There's a lot of things that go into effect, you know, a lot of policies, a lot of laws, a lot of issues that come to a head. And if you're not actively involved in, you know, City Hall or testimonies, you know, things like that, you're not going to be able to put add your voice to the record. And you're not going to be able to hear from other people who are living that reality every day. You're just going to hear, you know, this is up on the ballot and people are discussing this, and you're going to be like, what? We don't need that. Or yes, we need that. You need to go a bit further and you need to sit in that room with people who are going into City Hall because their lives depend on it. There's ordinary, regular people that are there every day on these issues. It's not just walking in and there's a bunch of suits there. There's people that are like, this is a very serious issue for them. And if you're not there to listen to them and see their perspective and be able to resonate with that, how are you going to be able to know what you need to know to make a difference? And I think, you know, whether you're involved civically by actually going and participating, or you're following, you know, Don't Shoot Portland, we try to post a lot of different calls to action. We're always seeking volunteers and support and, you know, bringing community in, because we were displaced for a few years. We finally have a location as of February 2023, and now we just want to be able to come together as a community and like reassert our presence. And that means, you know, Reclaim MLK is coming up. Let's build that out. Let's build out a committee of people that care, of businesses that care, entrepreneurs. There's so much work for us to do together, and you know, time is of the essence. I feel it truly is. And
First of all, I want to walk back for 1 second when you said people should be participating more in the civic life of the city. The archives, we're talking about the public record. Every time somebody does that 3-minute commentary in front of the city council, that becomes part of the public record. I just think it's great. I'm not allowed to make a call to action as a programmer here at KBOO because it's FCC rules. But I just want to say it's amazing when people do that. And I do want to encourage people, think about what is the public record. You know, 10 years from now, there's going to be an investigative reporter from the, I don't know, Carrot Weekly newspaper, something that doesn't exist anymore, assuming that we have newspapers. That person's going to be looking through documents. They're going to use search engine optimization terms to digitally examine documents and look for things, kind of like the Donald Trump indictments where there's 1.5 million documents. You use a search engine to look through that. Your opinion could actually be at the top of what people understand in the future. And, you know, I just want to plant that seed in people's minds. So, Ty, you had mentioned Reclaim MLK.
Yes.
What is that?
So this would be our 10th annual march in January to celebrate the work of Dr. King. Every year it's a children-led march. All year long leading up to it. We also, you know, we do art making workshops. We've done a couple of those with the Pacific Northwest College of Art this year.
That's right.
And it's amazing. Like I said, it's another way to build community, and then other communities come together so that we can amplify their issues as well. So it ends up being this very big intersectional march where, you know, you'll look over here and you see the Tigray community is vocalizing the genocide that's happening. They're giving you ways to support. They're giving you ways to amplify. You look over here and, you know, Hot Soup Collective, they're over here feeding people at the park.
Free hot soup.
Yeah, before we even leave the park, people are showing up in unity. They're tabling, they're feeding people, and it all comes together before the march, during the march. We're looking out for each other, and we're building solidarity at the end of the march, and that kind of gives us a way to move forward for the year. You meet people at this march. Like I said, this is going to be our 10th annual. Might even be our 11th. I'm like so bad with the
times. The COVID stole years away. Go ahead.
But I've met people that, you know, met at the march, got married, had children, and then I see, you know, they show up, they're pregnant. The next year, baby's in a stroller. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, it's beautiful too, because that's the way to do it. Like, these children aren't going to be, have this pivotal moment in their life where they have to experience a tragedy, you know, that shapes them. And they're like, oh my gosh, I remember when my friend, this happened and it was wrong. And now my life is forever changed. These kids are being raised and seeing that that's normal. Oh, I'm going to advocate. Oh, I'm going to march. Oh, I know who Dr. King is. I know what civil rights means to people. Like, they're going to grow up knowing that that's the way that they should be helping each other in the world. And it inspires me. Like, I see these kids, you know, getting on microphones. They end up on Time magazine, a six-year-old, yeah. You know, and he protests here. He leads protests, and he's very well informed. He knows what he's talking about. He can name different civil rights leaders and name what needs to be changed. And he's like 6 years old.
One of the things that does amaze me about Don't Shoot Portland, and this goes back for years, is the consistent involvement of people of all ages. And I know that a lot of people will say they do that, but it's different what Don't Shoot Portland does. So are you the board president?
Yes, I am.
What are you most excited about in terms of future directions for Don't Shoot Portland?
Don't Shoot just opened our own art gallery in April. It's called the Black Gallery, blackgallerypdx.com. We're super excited about that because it's, you know, just an extension of our work. It's in the Pearl District, so we're surrounded by other amazing galleries, but we definitely, you know, we're wanting to amplify what we have going on there. We're wanting to create a space for Black artists and for artists that are civically engaged, their work speaks to social issues, and they're trying to like push the envelope forward. We're all about that. So the Black Gallery is something I'm very excited about because I am in the arts. I'm the gallery manager there, and being able to, you know, do studio visits and like learn what these artists are wanting to create and why they feel it's like their purpose in the world, it's extremely inspiring. Because sometimes the world is not giving you a lot of feel-good news and reasons to keep moving forward. You just have to kind of dig deep and find that in yourself. And for me, artists, even if they themselves don't know, you know, they're like, I don't know why, but this is helping me. It helps me. It helps everyone. Being able to, like, find your source of creativity and share that with the world is, like, it's powerful. So for me, having the gallery, we're able to kind of focus more on promoting artists and uplifting that art to people who might not normally see it. Like I said, we're in the Pearl, so people are, you know, walking by, they're not expecting to see the Black Gallery, and they're like, wait a minute, what is this? And those are really good conversations that I get to have, and it feels good.
Also, I want to quickly say, this is a tiny renaissance for Black artists in Portland. Actually, some of the greatest artists in the entire history of the state happen to be African American. And there have been a few renaissances of African American artists in Oregon. But right now, Intisar Abioto has curated this huge show at the Portland Art Museum. And people could go check that out. When you look at art, the art I love best actually brings people together for a purpose. And that sounds like really weighty and kind of pretentious, but that's what it's a meeting of the minds. That's the way I feel about it. Now I have to ask you this this is the biggest question of all, Ty. How do people volunteer with you?
So if you go to don'tshootpdx.org, there's a link to volunteer. We definitely could use some, you know, reliable and dedicated folks that are wanting to enact social change in their communities. We're very much grassroots. You know, I keep saying my mom throughout this conversation, but I mean Teresa Rayford, our executive director and founder, and I'm the board president. So, you know, we are a small team. We've got committees of some dedicated volunteers, but we could always use more momentum and, you know, just mobilizing folks. So reach out on our website and, you know, come in to the gallery, speak to me. I'm always there, you know, guiding tours and things like that. So we would love to just connect with more community.
So people who love history, people who love art, people who can set up chairs, people who can sit on chairs at a table. Is there any kind of skill you really need from people who are out here? Maybe people who don't have a job and they're waiting to get a job and they need some kind of volunteer gig. What kind of skills do you need?
We would love another Nate, you know, another volunteer coordinator. you know, that is like such a massive help. And we would also love to work with more artists, you know, to be able to create some work that can, you know, speak to our mission, some work that can also, you know, speak to others and engage them. We love doing, you know, we love publishing community education materials. So we've done a couple of pamphlets on, you know, critical race theory. We've done some on mutual aid. We've done infographics on the school to prison pipeline, little things like that, that can help people kind of learn about one aspect of something, and it's not so overwhelming, you know. It just makes it easier for folks to digest that information. So looking for artists, advocates, lawyers, educators, come on through.
And chair setter uppers.
Yes.
So that's it for our show. This is Keeping It Real. I'm Lisa Loving. Thanks to our guest, Ty Carpenter of Don't Shoot Portland. Find out more about them online at don'tshootpdx.com. Special thanks to KBOO Public Affairs Director Ender Black and Program Director Asia Hawthorne for making all of this possible. Yeah. We're going to play you guys out. And thanks for listening, and stay tuned. Volunteer at kboo.org.